Hello friends, and welcome, back. It's wonderful to see you all, even at such great distance. Wow. Wonderful to see you at distance and nearby. I encourage everyone to let their video be seen, if you're willing. This helps everyone stay connected. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. The technology of this will never cease to amaze me. It boggles my mind that that this is even possible. And yet, here we are. People have asked me recently, how do I do this when I'm so afraid? Life is hard. Things are upsetting, even though I'm physically well, I have enough food, my house is warm, my garden is beautiful, and I'm afraid. So I thought I would study this thing we call fear and put it in the context of, in our practice, what we call fearlessness. So I think I will first lead you into how I began to study this. Starting with my own mind and heart, of course, starting place, and touched into a couple of the resources in our lineage. Primarily, as it turns out, Dogen and Shakyamuni Buddha. Fearlessness is one of those words that's kind of slippery. It is actually possible to live without fear, and yet, sometimes fear is exactly the right response. So, recognizing when fear is helpful, or when fear is a constraint, is part of the inquiry of this practice we call Zazen. The Buddha taught about this to his people. The hermits, nuns, and monks who were his followers had moments of great fear. So he taught a teaching that we now hear as Baya Bhairava Sutra. And that translates as the teaching about fear and terror. And basically he taught them how to sit and become at ease, become stable in their fear. Not to push it away, to just become stable. So this practice we have called Zazen is the practice of just sitting, becoming stable. When we talk about just sitting, the just is referring to this single-minded, diligent practice without any intervention, without anything extra. There's no intervention of ego interest or ego concern or ego desire. Just sitting. Not trying for something else or trying to be somewhere else or someone else. Just sitting. engaging in this practice, as Dogen talks about it, engaging in this practice in the midst of original realization. And later in Dogen's teaching, he began to call this practice realization. We hear that as two words, but actually he put them together in English. We hyphenate it now. Practice realization as one thing, not a thing, as one event. So that little hyphen in practice realization requires study. And we have to understand, at least in part, what is practice and what is realization in order to comprehend the depth of that hyphen. By hyphenating practice realization, what we begin to see is that meditation is not a means to an end. It's not that first there's practice and then there's realization. It is as Catherine used to say it, we live in this space between before and after. So this hyphen indicates that there is nothing before and nothing after, or rather, maybe to say it, that the gap between before and after is closed. And since there's no goal, no ego interest, no ego concern, we would have to say, before and after what? You know, before and after realization? Well, no, because that's always and already present. Before and after now? Actually, there's just now a new now, which appears in our logical way of thinking to be a new now, but actually it's one continuous now. So a distinction between enlightenment or realization that might be acquired because of doing practice diligently, for example, or original enlightenment or realization, making a distinction like this is unnecessary and I would say useless. And to make a distinction like this takes us down the wrong trail. Meditation, I would say, is a practice of discovery. Discovery, kind of a deepening process of becoming aware of original enlightenment that has always been present, whether we knew it or not. And the awareness has an experiential component that is the set of conditions known as you. A set of conditions currently known as Jean showing up in present moment awareness. So it's not that anything is gained or acquired. It is simply that delusion has begun to disintegrate, literally disintegrate. So this is what Dogen calls continuous practice, or practice realization. This is the experience of bringing attention to every moment. This is the experience of not turning away. And that has something to do with fearlessness. I'm not exactly sure, but I wanted to explore it. When we chant the Heart Sutra, for example, we say, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita. That's the perfection of wisdom. That would translate that way. Bodhisattva relies on the perfection of wisdom, and thus the mind is without hindrance. That little thus is another one of those things like the hyphen, that little thus explains. So there are at least 5 volumes of the Buddha's teachings. And one of them is called the Long Discourses, and one of them is called the Medium Discourses, and one of them is called the Short Discourses. And another is called the Numerical. They're put in order. And another is, many of those same discourses are organized by themes or topic. So I would say that thus that we chant in the Heart Sutra, a bodhisattva relies on the perfection of wisdom, and thus the mind is without hindrance. That thus summarizes all 5 volumes. So that is a good place to study. The next line that we chant, without hindrance, there is no fear. This tells us something about fearlessness. So what we can begin to see and study and read and examining our own life. Bodhisattvas do not turn away. This is what we might call fearlessness, not turning away. Normal people like us recognize the tendency to turn away, and then we cultivate a capacity to return. This returning is what Dogen calls continuous practice. There's a group of people, international now, group of people, maybe 500 or more, that are participating in the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care practice period that is being done online. And the theme of that practice period is continuous practice. So I'd like to read to you what a few days ago, maybe on day 34 of 90 days, so just a few days ago, this one is the one that came out. They're quoting little sections of Dogen's continuous practice. The Japanese title is Gyoji. So, in the continuous practice of the Buddha ancestors, you should not be concerned about whether you are a great or modest hermit, whether you are brilliant or dull. Just forsake name and gain forever, and don't be bound by myriad conditions. Do not waste the passing time. Do not wait for great enlightenment, as great enlightenment is the tea and rice of daily activity. This brings us to the requirement of studying, engaging in our daily activity, waking up, or as awake. So this wholehearted attention is our way of practice, is our family style of practice. Where does this continuous practice abide? Does it abide? It's not abiding in the sense that we would normally understand it in English, as in staying put, because it's not static, it's responsive. It requires interaction and exchange. So this continuous practice abides in the living of it. Someone commented to me recently, it's not easy being human. Right? Life is difficult. Life can be really hard. And I would say because of our current environmental and social conditions, it's no longer possible to ignore or pretend that change isn't needed. And in some ways, this makes our life even more difficult. I have to ask myself these days, will this time be different? Will the revolution actually take hold? And I will tell you why I feel optimistic. I am celebrating, actually, that yes, this time is different. In part because I feel, at a global level, heart and mind have finally met. In my explorations to study that very thing, heart and mind, also has something to do with fearlessness. I came across a short poem. The author's name is Eduardo Galeano, and the book I'm reading from is called El Libro de los Abrazos, or The Book of Embraces. And in honor of Eduardo's culture, I will read his little poem first in his language, in Spanish, and then I'll offer you a translation. Celebración de las bodas de la razón y el corazón. ¿Para qué escribe uno si no es para juntar sus pedazos? Desde que entramos en la escuela o a la iglesia, la educación nos descuartiza. Nos enseña a divorciar el alma y el cuerpo, la razón del corazón. Sabios doctores de ética y moral han de ser los pescadores de la costa colombiana que inventaron la palabra sentipensante para definir al lenguaje que dice la verdad. So my rough translation. This is a celebration of the wedding of reason and heart. For what does one write if not to gather one's pieces? From the time of entering school or the church, education cuts us into parts. It teaches us to divorce the soul from the body and reason from the heart. The wise doctors named ethics and morality have to be like the fishermen off the Colombian coast who invented the word feeling thinker to define a language that speaks the truth. So this feeling thinker, in maybe you captured it in listening, sentipensante. So my hopefulness for our future lives in this sentipensante, being feeling thinkers together. It's not easy being human. So the Buddha's teaching, when his people asked him, life is difficult, it's not easy being human, they also said the same thing. And in particular, they were talking about forest life being difficult, that when they were in their alone time in the forest, they became afraid. And naturally so, afraid of things that could be dangerous to them. But the Buddha helped them discover what was under their fear. So he taught them about being feeling thinkers. And he taught them about not turning away. So when they asked about fear and terror, he said that it's the fault of their unskillful mental activity that their fear is unskillful. You know, he didn't diminish in any way the ways in which fear could be helpful to keep them safe, for example. But he really brought it into when is fear unskillful, and let's do some work there. So the Buddha didn't often speak this, I want to say directly or harshly. But in this particular sutra, the Bhayabharata Sutra, he said, it is the result of their drooling idiocy that fearfulness of the forest arises. And then he helped them to kind of just unravel their idiocy. So you have minds of ill will, and so you're blaming. You have restless minds. You can't find your stillness. You're busy disparaging others, and so you're creating separation. You're desirous of gain and fame, and so you're creating hierarchy where there is none. This is what he started to call their drooling idiocy. So he said, this is how I practice, and used his own life. The Buddha was very, very talented that way in his teaching, always bringing it back to his own experience, and said, now, please make it your experience as well. So the response to ill will becomes stable and offer goodwill. The response to restlessness becomes stable, be settled. The response to disparaging words becomes stable and offer encouraging words. The response to your wish for gain and fame becomes stable and abide in modesty. To develop this kind of goodwill, I believe, takes the activity of an inquiring mind and an intuitive open heart. This is being feeling thinkers, senti pensantes. So settled in this broadened view, the Buddha said, because I am settled, fearlessness arises. I feel undaunted about staying in the forest. We can bring that forward in time, in our own settledness. Of course, it's not easy being human. Become stable, and fearlessness arises. We have this, of course, in the Sino-Japanese words that we use. I have spoken many times about the character Shin that translates as both mind and heart, according to Kaz Tanahashi. And in some, if I look it up in the dictionaries, it translates as heart, mind, spirit. This coincides quite well with the Spanish corazón, and coincides quite well, of course, with the French cœur. Courage lives in the center of these words. In the character for Shin also has another pronunciation, and that pronunciation is kokoro. And in school, or when I'm practicing taiko drumming with the community in Watsonville, the teacher might call out, kokoro. That is an encouragement to bring forth some vigor and bring forth some spirit. But it means mind, heart, spirit all rolled up into one event. This is what I would call continuous practice. Dogen teaches continuous practice is the circle of the way. It doesn't matter whether we see that or not, or believe that or not. It's just the nature of life. This, we live in this river or flow of non-repeatable events. This is just the nature of life. This is continuous practice. Dogen continues. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is unstained. So, similar to what the Buddha taught about not cultivating drooling idiocy. This continuous practice is unstained by our thinking, by our naming, by our categorizing or wishing to be somewhere else or someone else, or by anything that would be contrived. And Dogen points out quite directly, continuous practice is not forced by you or others. Continuing with Dogen's words for just a bit here. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. It is not noticed by you. So we're not going to be involved in expecting a prize or a reward for being good bodhisattvas or for living honestly with kindness and compassion, because being settled and fearless, you don't even know that you're being a bodhisattva. You're just living. So no self-praise, because self-praise doesn't even enter that domain. Continuously really means continuously. It doesn't mean just during zazen or just when I'm studying or just when I'm having a Dharma conversation. It really means continuously, all the days, all the nights, all week, and awakening continuously to this, just the natural flow of our lives, is actually possible. For a while, we might take it on faith if we have trust in someone, that whatever they're saying, if we trust them, could be true. But ultimately, we have to test it out against our own lives. How does it actually work for you? I'll read the whole chunk from Dogen uninterrupted by my attempted explanations. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is unstained, not forced by you or others. The power of continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means that your practice affects the entire earth, the entire sky in 10 directions, although not noticed by others or by yourself. It is so. So affirming this for myself in my own life, this continuous practice kind of arises involuntarily, not because I have willed it, not because I have forced it. It's just within the experience of mindful attention to what is actually happening. The task is to stay grounded. And in this time, you know, we're ramping up to kind of the political cycle. We're already in the political cycle, and it's potentially an enemy-making time. Please don't allow that to happen. It's not necessary to make enemies. It's fine to stay true to yourself. Stay true like a wheel is true when it's balanced, and meet each moment fully. Not necessarily turning towards something you would prefer, and not turning away from what is displeasing, not turning away from the present moment as it is. Actually, you know, words are kind of problematic. It's not even possible to turn away from the present moment as it is, because the present moment includes our turning away. So we could say, not turning away from turning away. This is actually our life. I want to read to you from Blanche Hartman, a senior Dharma teacher from San Francisco Zen Center, now deceased. She taught me about teaching sewing. Wonderful teacher, and who she lived in community for quite a long time. So she had a lot to say about what it was like to live in community. We arise fresh in each moment in response to the causes and conditions of each moment, which is why we say that each moment is empty of some separate continuous entity. There's no fixedness to us. We are continually responding to the connectedness that exists among all of us. Each of us affects everyone, and everyone affects each of us, so building these bonds of Sangha are an important part of who we come to be after practicing together with each other. Those we practice with influence us and are influenced by us. And I would say that the scale of this kind of increases, you know, we're influenced by and we influence each and every one we meet, whether we know it or not. So we might as well bring conscious awareness, inclusivity, patience, kindness, because this is the moment we are busy creating and co-creating. Blanche had something to say about drooling idiocy also. A little bit later in that same piece, she describes a moment when she was walking at Green Gulch Farm from her housing to the Zendo, and she had a totally pleasant moment of walking by the pond and enjoying the morning as it arose. And then when she sat down in her seat in the Zendo, she was in a state of fear and terror. And she said, well, what happened between the pond and my sitting down? And she realized that it was completely, solely a matter of her mind engaging in the thoughts. And so she had a clear realization at the moment, well, I don't have to walk down that road. I know exactly where that train is going, and I don't want to get on it because I don't like it. How about if I stop this process of thinking right now and turn toward the wholesome? And so she did. You might have to read the piece here on your own. I didn't quote it very well. The book, I'll hold it up to the screen so you can see it if you would like to find it. Seeds for a Boundless Life, Zen K. Blanche Hartman. Or email me and I'll send you the title. Anyway, she recognized, Dogen recognized, the Buddha recognized, people have been teaching this for 25 centuries. When we are engaged in grasping, this is unskillful. We can live in fearlessness, abiding in the present moment as it is. We might not choose this moment, and yet here it is. We might not choose the friends with whom we practice, and yet here we are, practicing together. We might not even like it, but that doesn't change the connectedness. And it actually extends backwards and forwards in time, through generations and through histories. So we live, as Catherine said it, we live within this space between before and after. That's not to say that we should become passive and just passively let whatever happens happen. We can offer criticism. We can suggest change. If it's in line with our values, that's fine. But if these changes are suggested without humor or without kindness or without humility or without owning our parts, it just kind of sounds mean. It's our duty, I would say, when we want to offer suggestion, change for the betterment of Sangha or for the betterment of society, for the betterment of family life, we have to put it in its correct proportion. Goodwill comes from this broadened view of being thinking, feeling people together. Sentipensantes, feeling thinkers. So, I might have an idea that is a good idea, but really I have to listen to this person first to find out if it's a good idea for them too. This person has a set of conditions, and they're living in a set of conditions that I might not completely understand. Therefore, I listen with an attentive heart. Settled in this broadened view, fearlessness arises, and then we understand the Buddha to say, I feel undaunted about living in the forest. I feel undaunted about abiding in my life. So, how can you use your daily activity to wake up? What is needed, really, in your own life to reveal what's already true and has been always true? What do we need to do to kind of peel back the layers of delusion and allow them to disintegrate? Let's have some conversation and exchange. Maybe you can start with, what are some moments of awakefulness or fearlessness that you actually have experienced, and what might you do to cultivate that in yourself and others? Or any other question, comment you would like to make? Yes, Sarah, please.
Mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I think the one thing that came to my mind when you asked that question is that in order to combat fearlessness, you have to put yourself into challenging situations, I believe, where you are afraid. And by facing those fears and overcoming those fears by doing that thing that you're afraid of, that is the way, I would say, of overcoming the fear that you have in your mind.
Yes. Thank you, Sarah. So what we discover is that it was unnecessary or unhelpful even to be so constrained with fear. And I would assert that this is the absolute best gift of Sangha practice, that we can engage in this kind of fearlessness with trusted friends, and we develop the capacity. It's like developing a muscle, really, developing the capacity to be able to accomplish this in the rest of our lives. There's a layer of this, though, that is a little bit tricky. It's not quite right to scold myself when I have been afraid. It's a lot more helpful. Blanche says this too in her book. It's a lot more helpful to say, oh, look, I noticed. And to give ourselves a pat on the back for noticing, rather than swatting ourselves with a stick for being afraid again. So this is true in my experience with teaching young children. It's true in my experience in working with animals. The positive and encouraging goes a lot farther than a scold or a swat. Other comments or questions? Yes, Susan.
I was just thinking about PTSD.
Yes.
And I think that's... I would think that maybe we're all suffering a little bit of this now, but in a discernment process, you can identify, is this my imagination, the future? Is this a memory or the past? Or is it right now where there's survival at stake and you need to take an action? And that's a very helpful discernment process for myself and working with other people. It's been very helpful. you know, just noticing, oh, that's not hot happening right now. Like you were talking about this other person. I've got a roof over my head. I've got food. It's warm. My garden's beautiful and everything. That's just something that I'm afraid of in the future.
Yeah.
Or that's some memory that's not happening now. And I think that discernment process is really helpful.
Yes, thank you. And I'm really appreciating the word discernment, because that's exactly what it is. It's that kind of close attention to truly examine what's going on. And actually, from my own body, I know this, the neurology of trauma makes it feel like it's actually so, right?
Absolutely.
So and that
it can be a re-trauma. It can be a re-trauma in that yes. moment so that it catches, because our body's remembering it. Yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you for mentioning.
Yes. And everything fires off as if the event is occurring again. Yes, that's true. So the discernment and bringing actual attention to present moment helps us dissemble the reactivity.
Yes.
It is possible to heal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Yes, Shakti.
One thing that I've noticed, as someone who lives with a disability, I have, I think it has actually aided my ability to be compassionate. Can you hear me? And so in a way, because we're all going through something that is, has sort of separated us and put us all into an alert stage of fear, you know, that we, I think it's helping a societal level of compassion, because we can all understand that everybody is going through something.
Yes.
Nobody is outside of that.
Yes. Thank you, Shakti. That's exactly yeah. so. And this is exactly what gives me hope. On the scale of worldwide, really, the scale of engagement with this thinking, feeling, finally, thinking and feeling have found each other at this grand scale. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Kathy.
What is it, do you think, about this time that is so, what is it about this time that is really encouraging the merging of a heart and mind, in your view?
Well, on one layer, it is people really get it that life is transient, right? So that has its gift of urgency. Like, all right, if this is a thing that brings death to my door, I'm going to start paying attention, because this is a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it, the urgency of the moment. And I think that, similar to Shakti's comment, we have all learned how to ask for help
mm-hmm.
and to be mutually supportive. Like, I'm not totally enjoying wearing a mask, but I'm going to wear a mask because I care about you, you know? So, and that's happening society-wide in some places. Anyway, I think there's kind of a broadened awareness of non-separation, if I were to put Buddhist words on it, a broadened awareness of non-separation and a heightened awareness of the urgency of the moment. Yes, Nanette. And how wonderful that you can be in Santa Cruz Zen Center without having to drive 14 hours. Great to see you.
Thank you. this is a little bit different, takes the conversation in a little bit different direction, but I keep hearing this echo of the Buddha's words, become stable, and become stable. And somewhere in there, as we know, there is meeting what's churning, you know? And it's always a question. It's a question that I hold so much is, you know, showing up when there's a lot of churning and, you know, how, this question of become stable when what I need to meet is my feeling, my instability in that, you know, in this moment. So I wonder if you would comment about that.
Yeah. So it's not the churning that's a problem. We can be present to the churning, you know. It's the hindrance about the churning that maybe we think we shouldn't be, or that this churning is going on too long, or something like that. So the churning is not the issue. Yeah. And I would say that the fearlessness of being stable, even while churning, is what allows skillful action to emerge. As long as we're caught in a hindrance about it, we're fearful and stuck. Was there more, Nanette? I'm sorry, I got kind of distracted by the sound interference.
Well, what I hear you saying is really meet and allow what's there. And that doesn't mean that stability is not present.
Exactly right? So.
Yeah.
Exactly so. And for those who have studied the 12-fold chain with me, thank you for that. It is exactly that we have pleasant and unpleasant and neutral feelings. We might think of churning as unpleasant. That's all right. When things are pleasant, we want them to last a long time. When things are unpleasant, we want them to be short. If an unpleasant thing persists, we start clinging to the idea of it should be some other way. So, anyway, I think you understood what I'm talking about. It's not wishing for it to be some other way, because soon enough, even the unpleasant things will change. When pleasant things change, we get upset because they've changed. When unpleasant things change, we love it because they've changed. There we are, being human. Thank you. Being with it. No hindrance. Any other last-minute questions or comments? All right. Fearless Bodhisattvas, I would like to dedicate this to the Dalai Lama, whose 85th birthday was yesterday or the day before, a couple days ago. And I was inspired by something he said. He actually invited and maybe even requested that people make dedications to him or chant for him or with him. And it wasn't about celebrating his birthday. The context he offered was, so that I can teach for 30 more years. Oh. Beautiful. Teaching even on his birthday. So, we'll close with our closing chant and then have announcements. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.